Good morning. So this morning we will return to the close application of mindfulness to the mind. This afternoon we'll move on to the final category of application, that is a phenomena. But what I'd like to focus on in this session, again this is very, very compact, this whole seminar, is the space of the mind. The space of the mind. And the space of the mind, I think it's a very reasonable phrase in English, not one we use all that much, but we do very often say, a lot of thoughts were going through my mind, or a lot of memories came to mind, or I visualized this in my mind, and so forth. Dreams occur in the mind. And so this is ordinary usage, in which case then we can take a special interest, if we're so inclined, in the space of the mind, the domain in which all of these mental events take place. And one of the first things we may note is that it's not, that space of the mind is not located anywhere in physical space. And if we wonder, where is it? Well, wherever there are mental events, the space of the mind is there, because mental events, like a thought, a dream, and so forth, can't occur outside, any more than colors can occur outside of the visual domain. They don't pop up in the, let's not go into synesthesia, but they don't pop up into the auditory domain and so on. And so likewise, mental events can only occur within the space of the mind, but not someplace outside of it. And so how big is the space of the mind? And I'll do my, this is now one of my trademarks, Mickey Mouse. I've traveled all over the world. I've never met anybody who doesn't know what Mickey Mouse looks like. And so I invite you to visualize Mickey Mouse on top of my head right now. No reason not to, right? He's the lord of my family, the Allen Wallace family. It's a Mickey Mouse family. But go ahead, just for a second, just for fun. But visualize Mickey Mouse right on top of my head. Can you do it? Yeah? About this size. And remember that big smile? Hi, kids. Like that right there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's really iconic. It's maybe the best known, maybe more than Buddha or Jesus. It may be Mickey Mouse by now. That everybody knows. And so there it is. So the image that came up, whether it's some of you may be very, you know, very gifted in visualization, others not so much. But what I just asked you to do was not silly. Visualize Mickey Mouse right here. Why not? You can. And so something came up. Now clearly, I think we all believe, nothing happened in the physical space above my head. That would be silly to think that. But a visual image, or a mental image, I should say, a mental image of Mickey Mouse occurred here, more or less, and as big as you wish. Where did that Mickey Mouse appear? Where did that image of Mickey Mouse appear? Well, obviously not way over here. You don't have some psychic ability to project mental images through space, you know. And so the mental image that each of you generated, of course, occurred in the space of your own mind, not in the space of my mind, because I couldn't see whether you did it or not. So the space of your mind is at least this big over here. Tibetans look at the moon and they see a rabbit. We see the man in the moon, they see a rabbit. You know, if you look for it, you can see its ears pinned back, it's kind of like that. And then other people look at the Southern Cross. And of course, there's no cross up there, but we connect the dots, and then we see a cross, and the Big Dipper, and so forth and so on. And so, in other words, wherever you're seeing a Dipper or a Southern Cross, that is not something you're seeing with the eyes. The eyes don't connect the dots, because there aren't any connections between the dots. If you're seeing a Southern Cross up there, then that's something you're seeing with your mental awareness. Which is to say, then, the space of the mind is wildly not confined within the brain, because you said that image of Mickey Mouse, I think we can be very confident that it did not occur inside your brain. It's a crazy idea altogether, but it's way over here, and your brain is over here, and I'm over here, and this is where you saw the Mickey Mouse. So to explore, experientially, explore the nature of the mind can be one of the greatest adventures we can embark on, and it's right there for us to do. The space of the mind is immediately present. And when I consider how the mind is very commonly viewed and referred to in just modern language, the modern media, scientific documents, and so on, it strikes me as being very similar to how the universe, the physical universe, or physical space, was conceived of before Galileo, before the rise of modern astronomy. Because before Galileo, and then this fantastic growth of astronomy and the expansion of our vision of reality since then, you may recall that the Earth, number one, God created all of this for us on this planet, and probably primarily for the Jews, but God created the whole shebang for human beings. We're the culmination of the whole creation of the universe, and we're here. The sun and moon, of course, the planets, the stars, they all go around us. And if you look with the naked eye, I think you can see something like 3,000 stars. And that's it. And that's space. Earth, sun and moon, planets go around us. And then there's all the decorations. Thank you, God. It's beautiful. Nice work. And so that was a vision of the entire universe. You know, one planet, one sun, and it all goes around us. And there we are. And so that started to develop a crack when Copernicus calculated mathematically, maybe that was off course, that not the Earth but Sun in the center. Galileo demonstrated the old view was wrong with his discovery of the phases of Venus. And then we've just seen this exponential growth of understanding and expansion of our understanding of space and everything in space ever since then. And one major expansion didn't occur until about 90 years ago, and that was until about the early 1920s, astronomers, the best of the best, as far as they knew, there was only one galaxy. And that was our galaxy, Milky Way. That was it. And there's nothing beyond that, right? And these are very, very bright men, and they had very good technology. But there was a telescope built just about where I was born, in Pasadena, Mount Wilson. And then in the early 1920s, Hubble, Edwin, I think his first name is Edwin Hubble, discovered, my gum, there's another, what looked like just a star, that's actually a galaxy, it's the Andromeda Galaxy. So he found, oh, there's two galaxies in the universe, cool. And then he discovered, I think, three or four more with this wonderful telescope, I think it was 100-inch telescope. And so, wow, three or four galaxies, amazing, places much bigger than we thought. And now, of course, just run that forward 90 years, and now with our better technology, the Hubble telescope, and so forth, now the closest estimate is that there are 100 billion galaxies. So in 1920, my father lived in 1920, one galaxy, and now 100 billion galaxies. And then for a long time, nobody knew whether there were any other planets or not. Now for the last 20, 30 years, now they're finding hundreds. And now the best postulation is that there are likely to be one planet for every star in the universe, on average. And every galaxy has somewhere between 100 billion and a trillion stars, and there's 100 billion of those. So going from this here, Earth is in the center, thank you, those 3,000 stars are really pretty, to this, and a universe that was about within 10,000 years old, which 40% of Americans still believe. Amazing. But they just don't care about science. You know, they figure there's one source of authority and that's it and they're finished. But from a 10,000-year-old universe to 13.7 billion years. So that thing, I just take delight in all of this. The expansion from a little kind of short story, a little tiny short story, 8,000 years old and 3,000 stars and so forth, to 13.7 billion years old in this cycle. And there are quite a number that consider maybe this is only one cycle. There are others consider maybe this is only one universe, and there are other universes out there as well, all out of phase with each other. So now ours is expanding, there may be another contracting, and there may be an innumerable number of these multiverses, all out of phase, out of sync. So the expansion there is fantastic. How did they do that? Because the modern astronomers are smarter than Galileo or smarter than Ptolemy? And the answer is no, I don't think we're any smarter at all, but the technology got better. That's it, the technology got better. And then you develop this theory, experiment, theory, observation, and now we have this really, truly wondrous vision of the enormity of space and time and the myriad worlds within it. I'm going to give one more example because I love astronomy and I think this analogy is right. Quite relevant, actually, to what we're about to do. Because when we think of the space of the mind, we're probably thinking about something about as big as the head, which I think is analogous to Earth in the center, thank you, 3,000 stars. And space is, wow, big. It holds 3,000 stars. But here's something from about 2000, I think it was 2003, 2004, something like that, quite recent. The Hubble telescope has been up and running for quite a number of years, and so it was in its prime, the Hubble telescope. It's about the size of a school bus, and it's orbiting around the Earth oh, I can't remember, 17 times per 24 hours, I can't remember, but it's really going quite quickly. And so the astronomers who are in charge of the Hubble telescope got very curious. They wanted to be able to direct the Hubble telescope as far back in time, which is to say as far as away in space as possible, because they wanted to do is see if they can get some photographs of of galaxies and so forth forming in the very, very early phases of the universe. So like 13 billion years ago. But in order to make such observations, then you would have to look 13 billion light years away, okay, because everybody knows that. But the problem is between where we are and 13 billion light years away, there's a lot of stuff. There are galaxies, stars, all kinds of things. And so there's something called light pollution. And that's why you don't, wherever Australia's greatest astronomical observatory is, it's not in downtown Sydney. Because of the light pollution, it'd be no good. You'd want it out there at Alice Springs or someplace out there where there's just no light pollution and the air is clear as possible. Hence the peaks in Chile, top of one of the peaks in Hawaii, and so on. So light pollution is an issue whether the light is coming from Earth, from cities, or whether the so-called light pollution is from nearer stars and planets and primarily galaxies. That if you have a lot of light coming from galaxies only 1 billion light years away and 2 billion light years away, then they will screen anything further away. Yeah? Very simple point. So what the astronomers did, they're so ingenious, they said, in the night sky, let's see if we can find the darkest area, where there's the least light pollution, where it's just pitch black. And they found a tiny little portion of the sky, about 1/13 millionth of the night sky. Or if you took a pencil and you held it out at arm's length with the eraser end towards you, the amount of space that the eraser would displace was about that big. So it's a tiny portion. But in this tiny portion of the night sky, it was just seemed to be pitch black. Like, wow, there's nothing there. Which is good then, because then there's no light pollution. And maybe they could see through the, you know, other kind of galaxies, because they're not in that little tiny region, and maybe they could poke way back deep in time and very far in space. So, but then they know what every photographer knows, is if you're trying to take a nighttime exposure, you have to leave the lens open for a long time. Everybody knows that, right? And so they weren't going to take a snapshot. What they decided to do was have this Hubble telescope take a 1 million second exposure, focus on this tiny, tiny little pitch black area, and see if they could get anything, just exactly like doing nighttime photography. 1 million second exposure. Now the telescope is orbiting around the Earth very quickly, so they couldn't in one orbit get 1 million seconds. So they had it click on that 400 times as it went around, and then layered all of the shorter images it got, and then add them all onto, 400 exposures, add them on to see, okay, now we've had a 1 million second exposure of this really, really dark spot. And so what will we see? Okay, good. Okay, I wanted to see. And you can see this online. It's called the Hubble Ultra Deep Space Probe. It'll come right up. I've seen the photograph. What they found was, in that little tiny remote area that was so dark that it seemed like nothing was there, in that area they found 10,000 galaxies. 10,000 galaxies. And the most distant ones were in formation only about 400 million years after the Big Bang. In other words, the photons had traveled 13.3 billion light years. And from these most distant galaxies, from an entire galaxy, the Hubble telescope was picking up one photon per second. Imagine how lucky that photon would feel. It just traveled 13.4 billion years, and it struck the Hubble telescope. Yay! That's winning the lottery. If you're a photon, it doesn't get any better than that, if they were, like that kind of thing. And so 10,000 galaxies in this one little dark space, and again, one galaxy, has 100 billion, 500 billion stars. So I just enjoy that. I just enjoy that expansiveness. And they're not finished. They're putting up the James Webb telescope. That's going to be the new generation. They're going to give the Hubble telescope a gold watch and retire it, whatever they do to old telescopes. But it served very, very well. And so this is what you get for just 400 years. Because basically no progress was made. in this regard until the telescope. And Galileo, as I mentioned before, started with a three-power telescope and during his lifetime improved his technology, which he made, and moved it up to 33 power, right? And before him, he was the first one to use telescope as a scientific device of observation. The Dutch invented it, but they didn't really do much with it. And I think, having been to Holland, I think they were using it, the men were probably primarily using it to look at women. That's just a guess. It's just a guess. I don't know. The military was interested, that's for sure, because, you know, who wouldn't want a telescope if you're in the military? But Galileo was the first one to use it as a scientific instrument, right? And that's 400 years. So that's not bad, don't you think? Not bad from planet Earth in the center to 100 billion galaxies and so on and so on. We, as William James said, when it comes to psychology, and he said this about 120 years ago, he said, when it comes to psychology, we're like in the era before Galileo, before physics, before astronomy, before Galileo, and chemistry before Lavoisier. And one day we'll develop the, I'm paraphrasing here, but one day we simply need to find the right technology to really explore the mind with the same type of rigor that astronomers explore space, chemists explore chemicals, and so on and so on. And so when it comes to the space of the mind right now, the general view, I think pretty much from everywhere in modernity, is, I mean, it's certainly coming from the scientific community, loud and clear, the mind is what the brain does. So whatever's happening in the brain is simply a function of the mind, which places the mind inside the skull. That would be the immediate implication, and that's everywhere in the media. And it's one of the largest superstitions in the history of humanity. I think it's more ridiculous than the notion that Earth is in the center of the entire universe. That what if we develop the appropriate technology for observing, and then better technology, Galileo telescope, 3-power, 33-power Hubble telescope, fast forward. We start by just having a 24-minute session, that's a 3-power telescope, to observe the space of the mind, and then you go off and do this for 40,000 hours. And over the 40,000, you're not just going around in circles, you're developing better and better samadhi, and methods of investigation, just like the astronomers had more than just better telescopes. They're asking better questions, and then different types of telescopes. And then it's this tremendous success story. But they had the technology, they developed further technology, and then this wonderful interplay between the technology and the theory and technology, to the point we got into, you know, curved space-time and so forth and so on. And so, in terms of the mind sciences, we have a lot of catching up to do. And we in the modern world can simply reinvent the wheel, and I see a lot of people doing this. Never mind, those Asian people couldn't possibly know anything because they're pre-scientific, and we'll do it. And I think this is a very, very common notion, that the mind is such a mystery, the mind-body problem is a mystery, consciousness is a mystery. What could they possibly know? Let's get on with it, we'll lead the charge. And this would be like, you know, a Neanderthal man coming out of a cave and saying, I think I got an idea about a wheel. You know, could, or he could just go to the city and learn really quickly that we got the wheel, we nailed that, you don't have to reinvent it all over again. So here we are. What happens if you spend, as the Hubble telescope had a million second exposure, what might you see if you have a 10,000 hour exposure, observing the space of the mind? And not just like that, naked eye gazing, but you're actually developing greater and greater stability, greater and greater clarity, greater and greater samadhi. I do call that the telescope of the mind. What might you see, and how big might the space of the mind appear when you have really developed the appropriate technology to explore it and what occurs in it? So, shall we check? Let's do it.